You're listening to Drake in the Morning with Wes and Sid on 98.1 The Max.
We're talking about various things with our friend David Waters from the Commercial Appeal. What a fun game to watch. And
I don't know if this happens to you when you watch college sports anymore, since we have this advanced age that we're dealing with now. But I try not to really, they look the same as they always have for me. When I was 10 years old watching it, or when I'm almost 60 now watching it, they look the same on the field. But if you really look at their faces, you can tell they're just kids. I try not to do that because it really freaks me out to think that these are 18, 19, 20-year-old kids.
Well, when the Bama quarterback pulled off his helmet at the end of the game, I thought, this kid looks like somebody in junior high.
He does.
And I thought, oh my gosh. Or you'll be on a plane someplace, and the pilot looks 12.
Yeah.
And you think, wait a minute, is this me, or does he just look that young?
Right.
Or even more frightening is a doctor who looks like he's about 15.
Yeah.
May I see your creds, sir? I'm not sure that you're really a doctor.
They're just kids. And, it just emphasizes the... I don't know what to think about the fact that millions and millions and probably billions of dollars are being made on the backs of these kids.
That's the problem.
Who are not getting any money out of this.
That's the problem that we could discuss forever. Last year, in this country, college football, I think alone, generated $3 trillion.
Wow.
Now, just imagine that. Thank you, Sid. And a majority of them are Alabama. All SEC teams, Texas, USC.
Big time.
It's the same culprits, but none of this money is going to these kids, it's just hard to understand why the great minds involved in this, well, there are too many great minds involved in great why can't they figure something out?
Right.
And don't tell me it's because they're getting their free education, because they're not and they don't care. Nor do you. They're all hired to play football.
Well, even the real student athletes, the ones who really do want to go to college and get an education and really work hard and graduate and do great things, whether they play football or not, even those kids should be getting more. There should be some kind of, I don't know if it's a profit sharing thing or a savings plan or something.
Yeah.
Maybe you can't pay them now while they're students, but after they graduate, there ought to be some way to compensate those kids.
Yeah, profit sharing, I think, is the term that's been used before because, at the, gift store on the campus at any school, they have the jerseys on sale. And if this kid's name is on that jersey and they get sold, why shouldn't some money be put back in an account for that kid once he graduates?
Yeah.
Listen, here is what your name, made us and made you, and here's 25% of it.
Nick Saban is making $11 million a year.
Yeah.
$11 million a year.
Yeah.
And he basically has free labor.
Yeah.
It just doesn't make any sense.
Well, and it's also the unspoken thing that don't think that these kids are not being compensated in some fashion.
Sure.
Or their families aren't.
Yeah.
They are making, but Alabama, I think, is one place. Maybe Duke and or Kentucky when it comes to college hoops. Those kids want to play there, and they'll play there for free.
Sure.
So they're getting some kind of benefits, but this is overly complicated, and it's the rich that take advantage of these kids, and these kids are not getting what they should deserve because as good as they were last night, some of these young men in this spotlight will never play on Sundays,
right?
And they will leave that program at 22, and then what do they do?
Right.
Have a car lot, down there someplace.
Yeah.
So anyway, but that was fun to watch.
At one point early in the game, I was really worried when I realized that Trump and Saban were in the same place at the same time. I thought, surely there's going to be a black hole that opens up and swallows this entire stadium.
Can you understand or explain why that occurred last night?
Why President Trump was at the game?
Because I'm trying to psychologically look at this and see what the point was.
Well, if you're thinking about it psychologically, there's been a lot of discussion even more lately, but ever since he started running for office about his actual, what would be his psychological diagnosis? Are we dealing with here? And everybody says he's a classic narcissist.
Oh,
and some
God.
People say he might be even like clinically, I think the word
sociopathic.
Malignant narcissist, which is a whole different realm, I guess, of narcissism.
Yeah.
Serious mental issue that needs treatment. But he's clearly a narcissist. So, I mean, narcissists are all about me, right? I need the attention. And the more attention I get, it doesn't matter if it's positive or negative attention. It's attention for me. And the idea of narcissism is that, you know, the classic narcissist has his own or her own reality.
Yes.
They're living in their own reality.
Yes.
So the more attention you get, the more it makes you seem like you are the star of your own reality. And I think that's what it was all about. I mean, you know, clearly, if the game had been in California, I don't think he shows up.
Yeah.
If the game had been in New York, I don't think he shows up. So he was
too many liberals and Jerry Brown.
But he hasn't even been to California yet.
So no, and that's I think that is a crying shame as well. That half the state is, you know, burned down, and he didn't even address that. Yeah, when you read about these things, and there was a book that came out called The Case of Trump, and there were 27 different psychiatrists that wrote their opinions of him from what they have seen. It was you know, pretty thoughtful thing. And then the lady who is the editor of the book, this came out last week. Mm-hmm. She's been to White House meetings with various senators to discuss her view on his mental state.
Right.
Now, this is not something to laugh at. I mean, if they're calling in someone to discuss how his, you know, brain functions, and is this out of control, and is it a problem, this ongoing, you know, sociopathic kind of behavior, the lying, which is chronic, and, you know, like him or not, you can't deny that the lies are endless.
Yesterday when he spoke in Nashville, he spoke to the Farm Bureau in Nashville, and among the many things that he said that were not correct was he talked about the $5 trillion tax cut. Well, the problem with that is that it's just not right. It's a $5 trillion tax cut overall, but then they had to add $4 trillion back through tax increases
right, to
sort of pay for it.
Maybe so lie is not always the right word. Exaggeration.
Yeah.
To benefit him, I think is perhaps the best way to say it. But there is one tenet of all of these things that once someone like him with that kind of mental state, once they say something, it is the truth to them
right, eternally,
whether or not it is true by anybody else's account.
Right.
What they say is the truth, the end.
Yeah.
And that's where you have the problem when you can't discuss these things or debate them sensibly and civilly with the president. And most presidents have relied on their advisors and their teams, you know, going back forever. He relies on no one but himself. And that is, I think, a part of the, we all need to be critiqued sometimes and listen to others and, you know, learn from our mistakes and go on, especially in that gig. But it doesn't seem to be the case. And
well, one of the things that people have said about him, and this came out in the new book too, Fire and Fury, is that he not only doesn't like to read, he just doesn't read. And he doesn't really seem to want to learn. And I think that's what concerns a lot of people.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to be the world's greatest reader to read briefing books, to be briefed on issues and topics, to get up to speed on these things, but you kind of really need to do that, you know, when you're the president of the United States, and you really want to and need to learn the job. You really need to learn what's going on in the world and what's going on in your country. And so obviously there's a huge learning curve for any president, no matter how smart they are.
Yeah.
But you have to at least want to learn more about it. And he doesn't seem to even want to learn. He would rather just sort of take his own counsel and not really get into too much depth about some of these issues and just sort of go with his gut, which has always worked for him in the past, right? But when you're dealing with nuclear issues and worldwide economic
issues. Building golf
issues,
courses, and that is a bit different than discussing a nuclear war with you know. Well, the book last week, it's all very, very interesting. This one is a bit different in that this guy, Michael Wolff, who is the co-owner and publisher of Newser.com, and he writes for other publications and was granted access to the White House, I guess, early on in the presidency, because no one knew who the guy was. He was a fly on the wall. This was all on the record. He has tape recordings of it and notes he took in the process of putting all this, you know, on, and it's, if it's on paper, on the record, and on tape, it's impossible to deny. But there are those that will you know, always believe that the whole thing is a bunch of hooey. It's a smear job on Trump. But the excerpts and what's in this book are a little bit frightening. And I fear that once this book is purchased by all those that want it and that read it, this will fade off into the sunset and carry no more weight than something did last month that the news cycle dropped after 48 hours.
Yeah. Well, I think you're probably right. I think the people who buy it and read it are the people who already don't like Trump or don't trust Trump.
Yeah.
Or want to invoke the 25th Amendment and move Trump out of office.
Yeah.
So this is just going to confirm what they've already believed.
Right.
What they already thought was true about him. And the people who support him still or support him, no matter what they think about him personally, they support his
They'll just
efforts.
Keep watching Fox News for affirmation that he's okay.
I don't know what you do about that. I mean,
Me either.
It seems to be sort of two realities at work at the same time in this country.
Yeah.
And there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of effort going on to sort of help people on both sides get together and try to figure out, okay, what are we really dealing with here? Let's move the politics out of the way. Let's move whatever you think of Donald Trump out of the way. And so we've got some real issues here. Let's see if we can figure this out together in some sort of more productive, intelligent way. I think it's a real problem. On the other hand, all this talk about invoking the 25th Amendment to move him is serious and scary stuff. You know, you could probably take just about any man who was president before, with maybe the possible exception of Obama, who seemed like the, you know, the clearest headed person ever. But, you know, Clinton clearly had issues. Reagan clearly had issues, you know, especially late in his presidency about his mental faculties.
Yep.
Nixon clearly had issues. Johnson clearly had some problems, paranoia issues and all that.
I mean, issues.
Yeah, exactly. And Nixon, too. You could probably find a way to really, if you really got into each president's mental state, especially into their presidency and other things going on, you might be able to make a case that it might be time to invoke the 25th. Or just about any president at some point.
Yeah.
So when you start talking about that, and then you start talking about a man's mental state without any sort of real diagnosis going on, real, you know, counseling work going on, I think that's a dangerous thing to do.
But, you know, just the kind of person that it takes to want that job.
Right, exactly.
That's grounds right there for a long, long therapy session. Just the thought that you want that gig, and then once you get it, that you are that you are untouchable, impervious to anything, and it gives you free rein.
Yeah.
And if you aren't an egomaniac and a complete narcissist, right, you will be.
It takes a certain level just to think you should have that job.
Yeah.
And we'll take that job. And then to actually do the job itself.
Yeah.
To have that power.
Well, you know, what you just said is an interesting thing, because I watched the new Dave Chappelle interview last week. Not interview. There's a new concert thing on Netflix. There's two different shows, one in a theater, one in a club. And it is the usual Chappelle stuff. Very funny, very smart, at times profane, without needing to be. But toward the end of it, he gets you know, pretty serious about stuff. And he brings up Emmett Till, and he brings up the past, and his point to this crowd of black and white and Asian people of all kinds, of all ages, and is that one thing that may come out of this incredible division we have in this country over this man and politics in general is that as everybody watches this fall apart, and it becomes, it just makes us more anxious and afraid of what's going to happen, because the guy is so unpredictable. And is it, this may be the tipping point that brings us all together at some point, because as each day goes by and this gets a little bit scarier and more uncomfortable and unpredictable, the only answer is for all of us to unite as one to figure this out, whether that means going to vote, whether that means making the statement, in these midterms in 2018, whatever the case may be, this is becoming a year into it. You know, I said before this, you know, this has become not fun to talk about. Yeah. It's become a daily cliche to see what kind of nonsense went on overnight and what has been, you know, turned loose in the media this morning. Mm-hmm. And is it serious or is it scary? I have a sense that Jeff Sessions' little act last week over marijuana will never be brought up again. It was a complete and utter waste of time.
Distraction.
It was brought up on the same day when it broke that Trump was really, really mad at him and wanted him out because he recused himself from the Russia, you know, thing. Mm-hmm. So Trump was pissed at him. So he wanted to show his might. And so he utters these absurd comments about invoking federal regulations against marijuana.
Yeah.
Dude, please.
Right.
You know, I mean,
what have you been smoking?
That ship has sailed. The opioid crisis. Remember that?
Right. Yeah. That's a little more serious.
I mean, it's just not entertaining anymore to see what the calamity of the day is from the West Wing.
Yeah. Well, you may be right. I mean, if you look at historically, we've sort of had these waves in American politics for sure. And even in America, these waves of fear followed by waves of hope.
Yeah.
And I think you could see that in there. You know, if you look at the election of Reagan, you know, not everybody loved the guy, but I think he brought a sense of optimism and hope that after the Nixon Carter stuff, people really needed that.
Yeah.
And I think the same thing happened
and
with Obama.
And he looked the part.
He did, and he sounded the part. And I think he really internally was that kind of person.
Yes, he was.
Yeah. I think the same thing happened with Obama after all the Clinton, Bush, Gingrich. I mean, you know, just constant fighting and warring between the parties and the problems we had. I think Obama came along and said, you know, we've got to do this together. This is one America. We have different views, but we've got to figure these things out and work together to make this happen. And I think that, I think you may be right. I honestly think that's one reason that there has been such a strong reaction to Oprah's speech at the Golden Globes. I mean, it was a fine speech. It wasn't the greatest speech ever.
Yeah, it was okay.
But it was very hopeful and it was very optimistic. And,
right.
And it sort of was like saying, you know, we're all in this together.
Right.
And I think that people really are looking for somebody to come out and say those kinds of things. Somebody who doesn't have sort of a, you know, an axe to grind, who hasn't been involved in all the partisan stuff. And there aren't many people left like that. And maybe you have to go outside politics to find that person.
Maybe so. But that that forum, I think that there are people that find it distasteful that the Hollywood elite at the award show, that is their forum for laying all this out there. And maybe this time it was appropriate because the allegations of, you know, all these men, they kind of began in abuse. Hollywood.
Yeah.
But the show and I mean, we all get it. And they all said some things that were, you know, full of meaning and they were accurate and there's nobody against what they were saying. But Oprah was being Oprah. I thought she's highly intelligent. Mm-hmm. She speaks incredibly well. I went back to watch this speech after I heard all these people just going crazy emotionally over what she had said. And I didn't think it was anything new, for starters.
Right.
It was to embolden everybody, and that's all great and well and good. But Oprah for president, it didn't, you know, move me in that way. Yeah. It was her over-enunciating and being Oprah the way that Oprah be, and that's fine.
Well, but before Trump, I would have thought Oprah for president was a crazy idea. I mean, she has no experience.
Her or The Rock, you know, which
right.
one do we choose
I mean,
from?
But now it's like, you know, Trump had zero political experience.
But we're adding absurdity on top of what's already absurd.
I do think that that's a problem. And I do think we have reached the point where we have to think about these things. And who is it we're in?
What is wrong with you? Think about these things? What is David Waters has lost his mind.
I apologize. I didn't mean to use the T word in a political context.
But then again, you know, one of the reasons I think that Mr. Trump is where he is because people were sick of politicians doing the same stuff over and over again. Yeah. And that was the bad rap on a Hillary is that it's more Clinton stuff. It's Clintons or it's Bushes. Enough already. We need a businessman in there to fix this mess. Mm-hmm. And that theory held water for a bit.
Sure.
Until you got what you asked for.
Right.
Which is somebody that doesn't understand the job and doesn't care that he doesn't understand the job. Right. Hence the no reading. He needs more executive time. He doesn't want to fool with this.
Yeah.
And that's the part to me that if he would appear to be engaged and stop tweeting like a child, this could be easier to take.
I think if somebody would take his Twitter account away, that would go a long way toward helping all of us.
Who is that person going to be?
It's got to be Kelly. I mean, right now, General Kelly seems to be the only guy holding that White House together. He seems to have come in and helped move that White House into some sort of organizational structure that seems to be at least halfway working now, where it wasn't 6 months ago. And I think Trump clearly has deep respect for military guys.
Yeah.
And he's hired a bunch of them. Flynn didn't quite work out, but, you know, these things don't always work out. But I do think he has a lot of respect for Kelly. I think Kelly has the sense and the understanding that these are probably not. And one of the things that came out of that book is how Kelly and others in the White House sort of, I don't want to say babysit Trump. That's probably too much to say.
I'd say babysit.
But, you know, I mean, they work hard every day to sort of mitigate the Trump factor.
Right.
Mitigate his lack of discipline, mitigate his impetuousness, mitigate his, you know,
childlike behavior.
Yeah. 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 And I think, obviously, that's a very good thing. But somebody has to get to the point where they've got to stop him from tweeting. I just don't understand why that hasn't happened already.
And, you know, and when, you know, I mentioned before, this is like coming out of almost every, it's just everywhere. Glenn Beck, who is a very, very smart guy, but Glenn has gone back and forth from being, you know, in the Tea Party to not being in the Tea Party to being an extreme right-wing evangelical dude. He's backed a little bit off of that, but he's changed his approach on this a number of times. But yesterday, they were talking about the fact that this entire tweeting thing, especially Sunday, about the how smart Mr. Trump is, he's a stable genius. We're getting into, you know, treacherous kind of ground here, and there's something not right. And if you want to, you know, restore some confidence in yourself as the president, put that thing down. It is not right. An acceptable means of how the president should be transparent or anything else. It is more infantile narcissism, which is what makes people that are watching this with hope lose hope altogether. It's not getting any better. It's getting worse.
Well, it's getting a little Orwellian.
Yes,
you know, because
it is.
Trump calls himself a stable genius. Of course, the first stable genius I thought
like
of was
really smart, and he used a comma after life. I mean, dude.
Well, the first stable genius we all know, remember, is Mr. Ed.
Which, yeah.
You know, I'm sure you can have all kinds of jokes come out of that. And maybe this is a different kind of horse. But
I don't know.
A different part of the horse.
But, I don't know where this goes.
I mean, clearly he's a smart guy. And there are things about Trump that, you know, he really has some savvy to him. Political for sure.
Yeah.
And some business savvy. But to call him it's one thing for somebody to call you a genius, but to call yourself a genius, I don't know. That's just
anybody who tells you how smart you are, or no, how smart they are, you know there's something wrong there. Anybody who tells you that they're this great anything obviously is flawed and their insecurity
is
so
for me
deep and true.
Is if he really believes that. Now, if he really believes he's a genius.
But narcissism,
right?
If you say it, you believe that it's true.
I don't have any problem with being confident. You've got to be confident in that job.
Sure, hell yeah.
If any job needs confidence, it's that one. And that's great. But
the arrogance that you know, transcends that confidence. And if you believe that, we really are in trouble.
Because if he believes he's the smartest guy in every room and whatever he thinks is the right thing to do, he will not take counsel from anybody. That's a very problematic situation.
Well, I don't know where this goes. You know, there is nobody but General Kelly that's can seemingly have any impact just on an hourly basis with the man. Other politicians, And I, you know, they have to get down now in the dirt with, you know, Schumer and Pelosi and Paul Ryan and McConnell and figure out how to avoid the government shutdown. Again, which seems this time like it might be out there. These proposals in the billions for a partial wall are patently absurd and are not going to happen. Yeah. And the lives of all these kids hang in the balance. But the this game playing, you know, and there's one more of these tenets of being narcissistic, is that you don't have any empathy for people, and you can't put yourself in their shoes. Mm. He has no more idea of what it's like to be somebody out here that makes 40 grand a year trying to raise two kids and just survive. Mm. There's no understanding or any grasp of what that's like. And so these kids who are, you know, it's complicated, but there's no empathetic approach to any of this, which I think is also kind of scary. And these El Salvadorians, screw them. Get them out of here. They're not my problem. We don't have any compassion in play here, which is also unsettling.
That's a really good point.
But there's just no heart. And not that much brain power either. But he is the president, and if he succeeds, it helps all of us. But I'm also getting tired of saying that because it's there's a new glitch every day, and we're a year into this, and the just the nature of how business is being done leads one to believe, you know, this whole thing with the Koreas, North and South, having a civilized meeting.
Yeah.
For God's sake, don't start tweeting. Let them have their moment.
Right.
Leave it alone.
Well, I mean, maybe it's the silver lining in all of this, or one of the silver linings is that, you know, Trump has, the crazy Trump has pushed people, even like North Korea, into trying to take a more reasonable, sane approach to things. Because Trump is so outlandish and so off the charts. And I think you see the same thing sort of happening in the Middle East a little bit, because the stuff he did with Jerusalem after 50 years of foreign policy, where we always said that declaring that Israel's capital is Jerusalem was something that needed to be negotiated for peace in the Middle East. He just sort of gave that away for nothing. He said, yes, it's Jerusalem. But it seems, at least initially, that Egypt for sure, and maybe Saudi Arabia and some other countries there, some of the Arab countries, have decided that, okay, we'll just let that one slide. We're not going to challenge that. We've got more important things to do.
There's been less.
I mean, you know, who knows? Maybe in the long run, not only will this make us look for somebody to bring us back together, but maybe it'll also help, you know, the world realize, well, America can't come in and solve our problems anymore.
Well, which may be
okay. We need to fix our own problems. That'd be
which,
fine.
You know, and yeah, there was less... I guess blowback might be the word from that than many people thought. The thing now in Iran is a little bit concerning, but the Middle East is and will always be a concern. But we don't have to be the world's police all the time. So, you know, there are just good things. There are bad things. There are many, many question marks, I think, about this entire process. And you also wonder, as has been suggested by people that know Mr. Trump, is that at some point, which is already in evidence, he's going to get tired of fooling with this and maybe say, listen, I'm going to go run my businesses and play golf. Y'all figure it out. And that, I don't think, is out of the question.
No.
Just his personality, his approach to this, his lack of engagement. It's too much work. He doesn't want to fool with it. And so he gives it to Mike Pence.
Could be.
What's worse?
Well, that's a reasonable question.
This one is an open-ended discussion that will either come to a conclusion of some kind, or this will go on for 3 more years. And somehow that doesn't seem to me to be likely. I don't know. David Waters is here for a bit more. Anything city wide. I see that you managed to work out one story last week.
I've been doing some other things.
But you can't talk about what you have coming up?
In a couple of weeks, I'll have something. Let's just say it's about events that happened 50 years ago.
Oh, well.
But it's not just about Dr. King and what happened.
What do you think we're going to see? And with a statue issue pretty much behind us, let's say that optimistically.
Hopefully.
And April, it's January 9th, Feb, March, April. We are 3 months away from April 4 and all that coming back. This city, I guess, will be inundated with more media and more celebrations and more discussions. What do you expect to see once we get to spring and get nearer to April 4 happening in this town?
Late March and especially early May, I think you're going to see the media everywhere, either in Memphis or talking about Memphis, because Memphis will sort of become the test case. It'll be the illustration for what happened to Dr. King's dream. And not only his dream from 63, but also what he said in 68 about the Promised Land and about the Poor People's Campaign. I mean, when he was killed, he was about to lead the Poor People's Campaign, the Poor People's March into Washington, D.C. I think it would maybe have been the next month before he was killed. And so I think people are going to be looking to Memphis as the test case. And it's not going to be it's not going to be a real pretty picture, because Memphis is still the biggest poor city in the country, the poorest big city in the country. And so I think Memphis, they're going to be shining a light on Memphis. I think that's one of the reasons that we had to get rid of the statues. I think that's one of the reasons that Mayor Strickland has put so much emphasis on things like downtown development, convention center, the airport revival, and all that stuff that's been happening in Memphis. I think we're trying to find ways to say, look at the progress we've made. Look at the progress we are making. Memphis is moving forward. We've got a white mayor in a predominantly black city. This is progress, and so on and so on. But I do think Memphis is going to get a lot of attention, maybe more than we want, for a couple of weeks for sure.
Well, it seems to me, as we watch other cities like Baltimore or St. Louis or Chicago on the south side, I think that we have, in this town, kind of dodged a bullet. There have been numerous occasions where things could have erupted into a really, really bad scene.
Right.
And they haven't.
Yep.
And I'm not sure what the reason for that is.
And that was true in the 60s, too. And that was true in the 50s. There wasn't a lot of sort of outward violence, public violence.
In the streets.
Like there were in places like Birmingham.
Right.
And so forth. And I think, I've written about this. I think one of the reasons for that is because this place is Southern, yes, and it's Deep South, yes, but it's also the capital of the Delta. And I think the Delta culture, historically and politically and otherwise, has sort of, people have lived together for so long in so many different ways, and they've all sort of approached it from a faith-based experience. This is a very faith-based community.
Yeah.
And it's a very faith-based region, and it's a particular kind of faith.
Yeah.
There's a heavy Pentecostal influence historically in this part of the country. And if you look at the Pentecostal history, it began, oddly enough, as an interracial, integrated movement in the early 1900s, late 1800s. Black people and white people were worshiping together. They were getting ordained in this. Black people were ordaining white people and so on. And I think that history and that culture made Memphis a different kind of place in terms of race relations. Now, obviously, there have been some awful things that have happened.
Yeah.
In the history of this city, regards to race, and a lot of the stuff that was happening was behind the scenes, and it was stuff that we didn't really see, but it was happening. So it wasn't happening on the streets. There wasn't a lot of riots and stuff. But I do think that there's something different about this place, and I hope that when the national media, the international media, comes into Memphis this spring to look at what happened in Memphis and what hasn't happened in Memphis and how things have changed and how they haven't, I do think that it's really important for us to help them understand that part of the story, that before 68, Memphis avoided, it really didn't have a lot of the violence that other southern cities had. Memphis was quietly desegregating all of the schools and the public facilities and so forth until 68 happened. And then since 68, like you said, we haven't had the kind of disruptions that Baltimore and St. Louis and other big cities have had.
So you're saying that there is an underlying unspoken foundation that was created here, let's say, many years ago, by black and white enjoying their faith together, and that set the tone.
Yes, I believe that's true.
Unspokenly for many years to come,
that was the foundation established. Right. And then you also look at the politics of it.
I never heard of it.
Boss Crump was the boss, a big city boss, and he ran the show, you know, and get out of his way or you had problems.
Right.
But he did do things that allowed, and to say this is just kind of absurd now, when you allow somebody to do something they have a constitutional right to do, but he did allow African Americans to do things in this city that other cities were not allowed to do. So there was a strong Republican Party that was African American based in this community for a long time. And black churches and black leaders were involved in the politics of the city, were very involved. They were voting. Now they were sort of voting for Trump because that's how it worked back then. But they were doing things that African Americans in other cities in the South especially were not allowed to do. They were allowed to register to vote. They were allowed to vote. There wasn't a big fight about that in Memphis. And so I think that also comes out of that faith-based, sort of integrated faith-based culture and history. So I just think Memphis is a different place, and I hope that those kinds of differences will come out in some of the reporting that you're going to see and hear over the next couple of months.
So we stayed civilized through the tough
times.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was the South, and we, you know, the police would crack down and, you know, drive. I mean, it was just insane, some of the things that would happen.
Well, the fact remains is that, you know, King was killed.
And we did
town.
Have lynchings here. And we did have, yeah. Know, we did have those things that happened everywhere. They happened here too.
Yeah, the past is pretty ugly. And the older you get and the more you look at, you know, look at how we got to where we are now, the more you realize about the inappropriate and just the, you know, plain old, wrong things that went on. And we're going to be hearing about that a lot from here until April 4. Thank you for your time and the great discussion, as always. I thank you.
Keep looking for those silver linings.
You really got to. There is no choice except to give up, and we don't really have that option. So optimism and positivity, we got to find it somewhere. And if nothing else, it's entertaining as heck.
And if nothing else, you can just keep playing great music.
Well, thank you.
I think that is
the go-to for many of us is great music and great books and Netflix, because there's always something fun.
By the way, speaking of great books, I know you love great books. I want to highly recommend a book called Playing with Fire, which is by Lawrence O'Donnell, and it's about the 1968 elections.
He's on MSNBC every night. Very, very smart man.
It's one of the best written books I've ever read about a history, and it's clear and it's concise and it's just incredibly presented. It's hard to remember all the things that happened in 68, but it was overwhelming what happened in 68.
Is it a cultural look at everything?
There's some of that, but mostly it's just about the politics. Johnson and Humphrey and Kennedy and McCarthy and Nixon and Rockefeller and Reagan.
And RFK and King getting killed and all that stuff.
Yeah, all that, yeah.
And the Summer of Love all in one big lump.
Chicago riots and, you know, on and on. Vietnam, it's all in there. But
sounds like
it's a magnificent book.
A pretty feel-good read.
Well, actually, it does end kind of on a high note, so it's kind of interesting how that happened.
But and it's called again?
It's called Playing with Fire.
Playing with Fire, Lawrence O'Donnell. David, thank you, sir. Always enjoy seeing you, and we'll see you next week. A little break, and we'll return in a moment.
Email us anytime at mail@drakeinthemorning.com.